I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hi, this is Greg Rempe, host of the Barbecue Central Show, and you're listening to the Baseball and BBQ Podcast with your hosts, Jeff the Old Coot Cohen and Leonard Hollywood Aberman.
From the studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 240 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman. We welcome you back to our program, Leonard.
Hello, Jeff. I am here.
Yes.
All right. And ready to kick off episode 240. Jeff, we had on two outstanding guests. And it's so fortunate that I get to say that on a weekly basis. Yes. Because they were very, very, it was great to have them on. That was Tyler Koeppner. Now, Tyler Koeppner, a writer for the New York Times, now for The Athletic, which is owned by the Times, just a great baseball writer. And Byron Chisholm of Bad Byron's Butt Rub. I mean, that it's like two amazing guests, Jeff.
Giants in their field.
Yeah. But before we get to either one of those, let me just tell everyone that BetOnline is your number one source for the NBA and NHL playoffs this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker. Or unwind with one of our over 150 slots games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BLEAV, that's B-L-E-A-V, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online. The game starts here.
And Len, how are we going to be starting?
Well, you know, we're going to start with Tyler Kepner, columnist for The Athletic. Listen as we discuss baseball with Tyler Kepner. Back in high school, there were guys who started bands to meet girls. Perhaps the same can be said of this podcast. No, we're not looking to meet girls. Except we get to meet and interview people we greatly admire, respect, and long to speak with. We have had the good fortune to discuss baseball with some of the greatest baseball authors. And tonight, we get to check off another person on our bucket list as we speak with someone whose writing has been a part of my daily ritual. As for the last several years, the day has begun with a glance through the New York Times and a deep dive into the sports section, where I look to see if there is an article by this writer. Tyler Kepner is a senior writer for The Athletic, covering Major League Baseball. He previously worked for the New York Times, covering the Mets, the Yankees, and serving as national baseball columnist from 2010 to 2023. A Vanderbilt University graduate, he has covered the Angels for the Riverside Press, Enterprise, and Mariners for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and began his career with a homemade baseball magazine in his native Philadelphia in the early 1990s when he was just a young teenager. Tyler is the author of the best-selling K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, and The Grandest Stage, A History of the World Series. He also possesses a very special skill, and I'm going to hand it off to Jeff as we delve into that.
Thanks, Len. And by the way, we ran out of time, so I'm sorry we have to end this. I'm only kidding, Len. But that was a very long, nice introduction.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So my first question, World Series Game 3, 2002, who was the starting pitchers?
That was Ramon Ortiz for Anaheim and Leivon Hernandez for the Giants.
How do you do that?
I think it was 10-4 that the Angels won. They went up. They went up 2-1 there.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, let's. Can we explain?
But what was the attendance? What was the attendance?
I don't know. First World Series game in the ballpark.
We've got to explain that. So Tyler has a skill, and I heard you on another show that. What is it, from 1979 on, every World Series game, you yeah. could name the starting pitcher from yeah. each team?
Yep. Yeah, it's just kind of how my brain organizes stuff. The only difference, 77, 78, is those same teams, so I haven't quite committed that to memory. I can do some of those games there, not all of them, but and I can do most of 75 and 6, but I should probably learn those so I could just say my whole lifetime, but yeah, no. So I can just, I don't know. It's just the way stuff gets stored up there and it sticks and it doesn't leave. So, you know, I can't explain it.
You know, that's Mary Lou Henner. She has, I think, what is her skill? She could,
we call any date, any date,
any date. She could tell you.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah.
Something, any date in her lifetime. She could, yeah. She recalls it right away.
Right. She could tell you the weather. She could tell you, I mean, everything, right, on that day.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinated by stuff like that. I mean, this is just a very limited 6 or 4 to 7 little data points for each year. And it makes, you know, it, if you've seen the games and you know, it kind of makes sense most of the time, like who's starting when. And then if you remember the sequences, you know, why they made a change here or there, like, you know, it's just. But yeah, it, knowing everything, knowing what you did every day of your life, that's pretty wild. That's way beyond me.
That must make you a hit at parties.
Not really. No. No, nobody ever asked.
Well, maybe now.
They did. I'd always be prepared. If anyone would call me 24/7, 365, but no one ever really asked. So it's like, except you guys. So that's good. And occasional interviewers and stuff. But yeah.
Well, let's start at the very beginning, Tyler. You're born in Philadelphia and you started a newsletter at the tender age of 13, was it?
Yeah, it was a magazine, a monthly magazine that it started out. My friend and I, we had the same classes the exact same class schedule. So we sat in the back and kind of, I don't say goofed off, but just sort of put together a little tidbits about baseball, you know, trivia games or lists of hot cards or cold cards, kind of like Beckett Baseball Card Monthly back in the day. And then that sort of morphed into just writing articles, you know, just kind of about anything I wanted. And, you know, we kind of, I sort of realized pretty quickly that this is going to be like a vehicle for me. Like, this is like something I really, really loved. So yeah, I just kind of kept at it and realized that this was like my calling, you know, this is what I was sort of going to do and what I was meant to do and what brought me a lot of fulfillment and fun. So, you know, in 1990, I was 15 and I started doing interviews with the Phillies, you know, or at the Vet. I mean, usually with the visiting team, actually, because the Phillies ain't gonna need them. You know, the Phillies kind of gave me a field pass just to see how I would handle it. And that worked out. And I just kind of, once I got the foot in the door, I wasn't going to go back out. You know, I was lucky. My dad was in the Army Reserves with David Montgomery, who was the eventually ended up being the head of the ownership group for the Phillies. But he worked his way up from the, you know, from the ticket office to the executive vice presidency. And you know, my dad always kept in touch with him. And so Dave was like a family friend, a wonderful man. I think he told the PR guys, hey, you know, just give him a field pass, family friend, see how he does. He's got a little magazine. I'm doing an interview. Yeah. And from there, I just got the bug and still have it.
Nice. So assuming that you were a big Philly fan growing up, I'm a little older than you. I remember the 1980 Phillies.
Yeah. They were always like this mythical kind of team that was always, for the most part, dispersed around the league. But I mean, I went to my first game in 81. And then the first team I really clearly remember is 82. I went to the 83 World Series and playoffs against the Dodgers and then against the Orioles. So by then it was on, you know, and they still had Schmidt and Carlton and McGraw and Rose and Maddox and Greg Gross. And, you know, several of the guys were still there and they were all just legends. I mean, every kid in Philadelphia had that pennant with a scroll with all the names on them. You know, and I still have it right up there. So it really was a case of great timing because they were still, I mean, look, the team in 1982, my first year following the team, their official marketing slogan was baseball's best. Like they could say that, you know, Schmidt, Carl, and Rose, you know, who was going to argue with that? You know?
Right.
The guy was going to get, Rose was going to get, about to get the hits record. Carlton was the only guy with four Cy Youngs. Mike Schmidt was the greatest third baseman of all time. They had just won a championship. They were feeling good and they kept it going, you know, through 83. And then they tried to go to a youth movement and it didn't really work out so well, but they made it back to the World Series in 93, which was the year I graduated high school. So that was really fun to have kind of going out the door and then flying back for the playoffs of World Series from Vanderbilt was quite an experience. So yeah, I wouldn't want to grow up anywhere else.
We had the opportunity to speak to Greg Luzinski, spend some time with him. Bulls, nice. Bulls barbecue at Citizens Bank Park. He couldn't have been any nicer.
Yeah, that's great. No, he was gone after the 80 season. So I mainly remember him on the White Sox, but I do remember taking my son to his barbecue stand when he was little at Citizens Bank Park. And he signed the sleeve of his jersey. He didn't know who he was, but he had a Greg Luzinski autograph on his little, jersey when he was about 6 or 7 years old.
That was quite the thing. It was, I think if you put someone like that in Yankee Stadium or Citi Field, he's swamped. And yet there he's walking around. He's actually going from table to table, like, hello, you know, and like everyone's leaving him alone. You know, he's just a different atmosphere.
Yeah. He's one of the guys. He's like, it's part of the scenery. You know, he's a Philly, a legend, but it's not like, you know, he gets mobbed. It's sort of a respectful, hey, you know, and that's Greg Luzinski, and you know, it's cool, you know, at Philadelphia's a unique and special kind of place.
Yeah, it really is. And so Tyler, you have this magazine and you're doing it and you're having a great time, but then something happens. You get interviewed for actually the New York Times does a story on you, right? And what happens?
Yeah, well, that was all kind of very innocent. Like, I didn't have any kind of plans to publicize the thing at all. I mean, I was 14. All I wanted to do was get better and send it to the people who I admired. And so one of those people was George Vespe, who was a columnist of the New York Times, whose style I really admired. George just showed it to his editor and said, this might be a cute little story. So they called me up and did a little story in November of 89. And fortunately for me, they printed our mailing address and the subscription cost. So I started getting checks just flooding in from all over the country. And more than that, I started getting a lot of interest from around the country, from other media, other publications and TV and magazines and radio and all that stuff. So I got used to being interviewed quite a bit when I was 15. I know that gave me a kind of empathy for the players who get interviewed a lot and how to conduct an interview and what works in an interview, what doesn't. How to make the subject engaged and how not to, or how to turn them off. So that really helped me because I was just starting to learn how to do interviews and learn how to interact in that grown-up world. Getting all that publicity ended up really helping me just learn how to do it beyond just all the advice that I got, from in the relationships I made with the people in the business, Jason Stark and Bob Costas and people like that who were and are just, friends and mentors, but who, got a much earlier start than I did and really inspired me to go into this in the first place. And Vespe, of course, I mean, I worked with George for years and years. I worked with his daughter in Seattle and I worked with him in New York, and just every bit as classy and erudite but also, a fun, funny and fun loving guy too. It's been amazing really to work with. I work with George Vespe for many years. Now I work with Jason Stark. It's just, I'm teammates with these people that grew up reading and wanting to be like. So it's been a dream sort of career.
It sounds like you got your dream job, obviously. And fast forward a little, you interned at the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, but you started full-time covering baseball in 1997, I believe. And I want to ask you, since 1997, which season do you think was the most exciting that you have covered?
Which season in terms of as a beat writer, the team I was covering, or the Major League Baseball season?
Major League Baseball season.
Wow. I've never thought of that question. I mean, I think of 03 and 04 as being really exciting in the sense that you had really compelling LCSs and World Series. 04, less so the series, so much as just the story of the Red Sox. Because, growing up, it was always, and you guys know, for so many years, there were just some teams that never could win and that you sort of seemed fated that you would never see it happen. And you've sensed that even as a kid, the Red Sox and Cubs, those are the teams where they always, and it's never going to work out. They're good. They'll have some good teams, but something will happen because you knew that there was decades of evidence. And so in 03, when they both get to the LCS and they both get to game seven and they both lose, in horrific fashion, it was like you were witnessing the history that you grew up knowing about. And it was a Yankees Marlins World Series. It was a good World Series, but it was a Red Sox and Cubs choked again. Mm-hmm. And then to see the Red Sox not just win in 04, but do something unprecedented. Coming back from 03, doing it against the Yankees, winning it in Yankee Stadium where they lost the year before, and then rolling right through St. Louis. I mean, that was crazy. That was just, you were watching history. And then a little bit later, the Cubs, the Cubs break through in 16 and go all the way. So that's been one of the things that's been fun covering baseball in the 2000s is that all these teams that had never won have ended all these droughts. I mean, think about it. The Giants had never won in San Francisco. A lot of years, a lot of great players. Then they won three times. Angels had never won. Gene Autry used to collect all those big stars. They made the LCS. They would lose. Angels won. We see the White Sox break their 88-year drought going back to the Black Sox days. you know, the Phillies had a 28-year drought. The Cardinals had a 24-year drought. I mean, you know, and there, the Texas Rangers just this past year had never won. So the Washington Nationals, that franchise. So it's just, it's been Houston won their first. It's been really cool to see all these teams get a chance. And honestly, to see a team I covered win the World Series, the Yankees, the last team I covered as a beat writer for 12 years, I sort of finished with the story that you're sort of building to in every year as a beat writer. Can this team win the World Series? Will they? And in my last day as a beat writer, they did.
Yeah. I think that teams that are haven't won in a while, the Cleveland Indians / Guardians, I always find it fascinating that the Brooklyn Dodgers have a more recent World Series than the Cleveland team.
Yeah. They do, yeah. And they've done a lot of things right with that franchise. They probably should have won one in the 90s. They were good enough to win one. They had a lead in the ninth inning in Miami and gave it up in 97. The 95 team was incredible, but the Braves were better. And 97 turned out to be their best shot until 16. They'd made the playoffs a bunch around that, a little before, a little bit after, but that was their 1 year. They were up 3-1. Cubs come back and win. They just didn't have the pitch. They were just exhausted. They needed to win that series quick, and they almost did. But as the series went on, they just relied so heavily on this, on three or four pitchers, and by the end, they were just exhausted. But they came so close. And that was the thing about 16, was that you knew that you were going to see history, yeah, because both teams had gone so many decades. So if Cleveland wins, then it's the first one for Cleveland, and it continues this Cubs angst. And if the Cubs win, then it's 108 years, and it continues the Cleveland angst, which was a lesser of a national story, but obviously a big deal in Cleveland. So, yeah, they seem to lack some offense there, but they always have great pitching. And Jose Ramirez, and I'm excited to see how Steven Vogt does, because he was one of my favorite players to deal with as a player, and I think he's going to do great as a manager.
Tyler, I could pick from so many different articles, but I was reading an article that you wrote on Billy Wagner, and I just want to take this from the article because I thought this was very well written, and I want to read it and then just have you comment on it. You wrote, "For many candidates, clearing a path to the hall is like merging onto a gridlocked freeway." I thought that was just, you were talking about Billy Wagner, you were talking about other Hall of Fame candidates, but what did you mean by that exactly?
Well, thanks. Yeah, what I meant by that was that when he got onto the Hall of Fame ballot, there were a lot of really good candidates who were already there. Some of them were steroid guys who were not going to get in, but generated enough support that they were going to stay on the ballot for 10 years, you know, and sort of keep a backlog going. And you can only vote for 10, and 10 sounds like a lot, but when you look at the ballots, because guys stay on it year after year until they get to 75%, you look back at a lot of ballots and they have 11 or 12 or 15 eventual Hall of Famers in that group. And if you can only vote for 10, you've got to get some early support or you fall off. That's what happened to Kenny Lofton. That's what happened to Carlos Delgado and David Cone and a lot of like really good players who deserve more consideration, Jorge Posada and on and on. Maybe they're Hall of Famers. Maybe not. I mean, they're not literally, but maybe they should be. But Wagner narrowly avoided that fate. Because he got just enough support early. He was able to merge onto that crowded freeway and just putter along for a little while until the crowd cleared out and people sort of could see his case, his car coming at him a little clearer. And hopefully next year he gets in, because he came so close this year.
Yeah, I hope so. And speaking about the Hall of Fame, famously, the New York Times did not let their writers vote for the Hall of Fame, but now you're working for The Athletic.
Yes.
Which I know is owned by the New York Times. Are you allowed to vote for the Hall of Fame, or is that still? Yeah. Now you are. Great.
Yeah, I am. I mean, you know, the Times says, I really, you know, I give the Times credit. I mean, like, they've preserved, you know, when they bought The Athletic, they recognized what a great product it is, and they've let us, you know, continue to be that way. I mean, I say us because I'm at The Athletic now, even though you're right, it is a New York Times company. Owned asset. you know, the Athletic, the writers over there can vote, and we do. And that was a real treat because I've been eligible to vote since 2007, I guess. That would have been the end of my 10th year in the BBWA. But this was the only, this is the first time I could, you know, cast a ballot, put my name out there and tell everybody who I voted for. So I didn't think I would end up voting for 10, but I did. I don't think I would have voted for 11, but I did vote for 10. And I gave the 10th spot to David Wright for that reason, that I think he deserves a longer consideration on the ballot than just 1 year. I withheld a vote for Beltran because I know he's going to have plenty going forward and I can vote for him next year. And I very well may, but I felt like Wright needed that early support that like Wagner got, because, you know, it's easy to just say, David Wright, he got hurt. He didn't play long enough. But if you really look at his case, he's very similar to like a Tony Oliva, right? And Tony Oliva didn't get the Hall of Fame until he was very old, but he's in. And I think David Wright, you know, had that 10-year chunk of excellence at a position that's very underrepresented. So he was the only, you know, vote I think that was controversial, perhaps. But and Andy Pettit, I voted for Pettit because I feel like he's a historically significant player based on, you know, yeah, he played for great teams. He was a big part of that. But nobody gets to the World Series as often as Andy Pettit does these days. And, you know, to have not just the record for postseason wins, but to have performed really well. He had some stinkers for sure, but for the most part, he performed very well in the postseason. And to me, he's a Red Ruffing kind of guy. He has a historical antecedent, if that's the word there. That's really what I try to look for. You know, I try to look for people who you can remember for certain things and people who have a very similar case already in Cooperstown. If I could find a guy who I'm like, you know, Andy Pettit and Red Ruffing are pretty much the same guy, different generations.
Yeah.
You know, David Wright and Tony Oliva, different positions, but they're very much the same kind of track record. So I looked for those, and I felt comfortable with the votes I made.
And it makes a great point when you're talking about David Wright. I mean, I know he got what, 6.5% of the vote, but Scott Rolen, who got in, he started out like about 10%, and he built up that momentum to finally getting elected. And I guess same thing happened with Billy Wagner. So I can definitely see your point of view. And that's one of the hard things about being a Hall of Fame voter, I would say, because look, the people on Twitter who are very opinionated and just don't think and just spew out, oh, these people think, whatever. But it's a very hard thing to do. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's like, oh, it's torturous, whatever. It's a wonderful honor and it's fun, but it you should take it seriously and you should wrestle with a lot of these candidacies. I know I'm going to be spending a lot of time. I've already started thinking, you know, the two guys on this upcoming ballot, I CeCe Sabathia and Ichiro are in for me easily. That's easy. But Dustin Pedroia and Felix Hernandez.
Mm,
yeah. I can see a case for and against for both. So, you know, I gotta think long and hard about those guys.
But Tyler, so now I am going to, you vote for David Wright, but you don't really think he is a Hall of Famer, but you want him to stay on the ballot. Is that?
No, I think he might. I think he may be.
So you do think he might. So you, in your mind, you think David Wright might actually be a Hall of Famer?
I think he fits in the room.
Okay.
I don't think the room would be diminished by having him in there. I think it would be enhanced. Okay. But mainly, I see that, you know, certain players' careers are going to be shorter going forward. Players are increasingly evaluated on rate stats as opposed to counting stats. So David Wright had 1,777 hits. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it's more than anybody in the Mets has ever had. That stands for something. Now, you could also say, well, Michael Young is the record for the Rangers. You know, is Michael Young a Hall of Famer? And he's a wonderful player. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. But so it's not like if you're the team hit leader, you should be in the Hall of Fame. But that's something that looks good on a ballot, that's historic, or that looks good on a plaque, that's historically significant enough to make you take notice when you read that in the room. And I think when Buster Posey gets on the ballot, a lot of people are going to vote for him, and I will probably be one of them. But I think many people sort of see Buster as a sure thing Hall of Famer. I mean, he won 3 World Series. He was an MVP. He was a, you know, he was a guy. Like he, mm-hmm. But if you look at the totality of his numbers, they are a little less than David Wright, you know, the counting numbers. I think as we start to evaluate short peak guys or give them a little more consideration, I think David Wright is a pretty good short peak or a very good short peak candidate.
Okay. Now, one of the things, and the listeners of this show know this is, I don't know, a pet peeve of mine, that is if a guy is on your ballot 1 year, say it's David Wright, mm-hmm. and then next year you take him off. Now, I don't have an issue with taking him off if you have 10 players that you feel are Hall of Fame worthy on that ballot, and so one falls off. But I do have an issue if a player gets voted 1 year on your ballot and the next year doesn't, but you only have 5, let's say. Mm-hmm. Or like, how is he a Hall of Famer 1 year and not a Hall of Famer the next? And that happens because, you know, you see some of these ballots and that happens. If a guy is a Hall of Famer, in the way I look at it, if he's a Hall of Famer, he's a Hall of Famer, not, you know, this year he is a Hall of Famer, but next year he's not. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, everybody is entitled to change their minds, but their track records are in stone by then. I mean, they can be extenuating circumstances, you know, when their personal lives or whatever, but mm-hmm. me, I'm going to vote on who they were as players. I don't think that I will, you know, go back on a guy. I mean, I don't think it's be fair to him, unless you get into a numbers game where you're limited by 10 and mm-hmm. you have to. I don't think, you know, and that's a consideration too. Like, you know, you vote for a David Wright or an Andy Pettit or Jimmy Rollins, as I did, you know, and they will probably linger on the ballot for a while. And if you've given them support, you know, previously, that means you think they're a Hall of Famer. So I should continue to do that. But I'm fine with it. They all have historical twins in the room, and they all had the requisite greatness that I believe you need to have.
And I'm just going to ask you one more about the Hall of Fame, because it used to be that the Hall of Fame, it was a 15-year. You know, you were on the ballot for 15 years. Now it's 10. Right. Do you think that that's, and some guys just make it in their 10th year and some guys just don't make it in their 10th year. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it was a wise move to go to from 15 to 10?
Probably, you know, it's probably time after 10 years to, you know, if you don't make it after 10 years, what more do you need? I mean, you're already retired 5 years, mm-hmm. and you have 10 years on the ballot. It's like, let someone else consider it. It's not a death sentence, because there can always be a veterans committee, an errors committee that can consider you, and the plaques are exactly the same. It's sort of, I think, just like, you know, after 10 years, okay, the writers have had their evaluation for a decade. Now let someone else have their crack at it. And you know, and I think that process played out well for guys who the writers overlooked, like Fred McGriff. Like I never understood why McGriff didn't generate more support. And I knew that as soon as he got on the errors committee ballot, he was going to pass, and probably unanimously. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, Jack Morris and Alan Trammell made it that way as well. And I'm happy they did. So, you know, it obviously managers and umpires get voted on, but, you know, occasionally some players break through that. Interesting though, that when Bonds and Clemens and Schilling, fell off the writers' ballot, they ended up getting more support from the writers than they did from the errors committee, you know, because the errors committee gave them less support than the writers did at the mm-hmm. end. 75% is hard, man. It is hard. It's really, really hard. You can get 70%. Kurt Schilling got 70% 1 year. That's a landslide in any election, mm-hmm. any political election, any election anywhere, except it's 5% short of the Hall of Fame. So, like, you know, people say the writers didn't want Schilling to be in the Hall of Fame. 70% of the writers did. You know, right. I would have. I mean, I think it hurts to be in there. But, you know, and I think Bonds and Clemens peaked at over 60. Another landslide politically, but not not enough for the Hall of Fame.
That very high bar, absolutely. You're a best-selling author of a couple of books, K, The History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. I think your newest one is The History of the World Series, The Grandest Stage, right?
Yep, that's right.
Tell us a little about that book, and because we haven't read it yet, and I'm definitely going to get it, but tell us about that book.
Yeah, as we started off, you know, talking about my love of the World Series and, you know, just kind of how it comes somewhat natural to me to study it. So I thought it would be fun to do a history of the series, but not as a chronology, you know, not as a reference book, but as a story of the World Series and topics that come up throughout the history of the event. So a chapter on managing those games and the big managerial decisions and what went into them, building these World Series teams, that, you know, general managers, how they construct, how they found the right parts that worked in October, you know, handling the pressure of the moment, both thriving on it and shrinking in it. Mike Schmidt was great in that because he had two World Series. One, he was the MVP, and the other, he went 1-for-20, you know, and he was able to talk about his mindset in both of those and how different it was. So, you know, we had 7 chapters, and we had the last one was just a lot of fun stuff, you know, like a lot of fun lists and like retroactively rewarding MVPs for all the series that took place before they gave out a World Series MVP, you know, that kind of thing. You know, the all-time World Series teams and you know, just some fun tidbits that I thought would be worth sharing. So I'm proud of it. I think you'll enjoy it. It was a lot of fun, you know, talking to people who really, really succeeded on that stage and some of the people who didn't, you know, the Charlie Lee brands, you know, who gave up, big hits to lose games. Jim Poole, late Jim Poole, gave up Dave Justice's home run in the 1-0 game that ended the series in 95. You know, Ron Washington talking about just how he just missed sending Nelson Cruz back just a few steps before David Freese hit it over his head. So, you know, getting guys like that was fun too, and something I sort of dreaded because you're asking them about rough moments. But enough time has passed, and most of these guys are great. So it was a lot of fun doing that.
You know, as a writer, you must be asked to opine on a lot of books, and we're going to be interviewing Noah Gittel in a month or so, and he wrote the book Baseball the Movie, and I like looking at the blurbs before the reading the book, and the very first one is by Tyler Kepner. So you know, I look forward to reading this book, and part of it because of what you've said, it's the good book. So
yeah, no, it's an honor when people ask me to do that, and you know, if I like the book, I'm happy to put my endorsement on the back, because, you know, people were nice enough to do that for me.
That I wanted to ask you that because, you know, it's kind of like with our podcast, you know, we put it out weekly and we put it out, it's out there, and then it's gone, you know, it's not gone, it's out there. And then we go to the next one. With you, with the articles, you put all your blood, sweat, and tears into an article, but then you've got to be finished with it and move on to the next one, as opposed to a book, which you spend all that time on, and then you've got the book out there. Do you have a preference for which you prefer doing?
Well, I loved writing both books. I really, really love that process. I don't have a book going right now. It takes, you know, it takes the right idea to really, it really is, you have to be able to love the subject so much that you're like eager to do the work, and you want to do the work like, more than, I mean, you just sort of naturally want to know the stuff you're researching, and you naturally want to get it out in the world. So sometimes it's hard to find that right topic that both engages you and attracts a publisher. So I love that process, but it's not really steady work in the sense of like, you have a steady job, you got a steady income, you know what you're doing. So it's different, like the real world kind of possibilities are different. Like, I don't think I could just say I'm going to be an author, because you know, what if you don't have a book at that moment, or, you know, whatever. So I love, you know, it's a, you know, website/newspaper, because sometimes the Times prints what the Athletic writes, but sometimes you never really know. But I do love the print, the immediacy of you know, my job and what it's been for 26 years now, you know, that immediate gratification or satisfaction of working on something and getting it up, getting it out, getting it in, you know, right. having it come out. And then, yeah, going on to the next one, especially with beat writing, that's, it very much mirrors baseball itself. You know, you might have a great, you're really happy with your story and your notebook and your news you broke or feature you wrote or whatever. Got to go do it again the next day.
Next day, right.
What have you done for me lately? Right. You know, and I'm not, I don't write every day, you know, like I used to, but I do occasionally like to go back sometimes and just pick a random day from those 10 years I was on the beat at the Times and just see what I was writing about on May 23rd, 2005, you know, and well, that wouldn't have been because my daughter was born 2 days before that, so, but you know, it's just some random day, July 16th, 2002 or something. And just see how I did that day, you know, and usually I go back and I was pretty happy with the way it came out. You know, I was sad when the Times dropped daily beat coverage of the teams, of all teams, and then eventually dropped the whole sports section, because I felt like, done well, the daily beat writing can still be very valuable and really capture the snapshot of the team for that day. It doesn't have to just be like a how they scored recap of the game, but the story of the team that day, I think, is something that's valuable for readers and fans. But, you know, for various reasons that, you know, the Times moved away from that. You know, again, to the Times' credit, though, they recognize what an amazing product The Athletic is, and they invested heavily in it. You know, that speaks to the potential for profitability in sports coverage. You know, that the company like the Times would make that investment, and I'm just glad to be on that side of the fence right now, because it's an unbelievable team. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like you're working with the All-Star team every day. I mean, it's not just like an All-Star game where you go and you play for a day and then you go back to your team. It's like you go to the All-Star game and you're there every day. I mean, it's an All-Star team of writers, and it's a blast to be part of it.
Yeah. As far as the books, we had an author on who had started a podcast, and he said what he liked about the podcast was he could interview the person and then move on. With books, he said, you have to have a topic that you're going to live with at least for a year. It's the research, the writing, and then when it's all said and done, the promotion. So yep. You have to be, it's basically, this is something you're going to live with for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, I had 3 years to write both of the books, that a little more on the first one, a little less on the second one, but roughly 3 years. I mean, I just, some of my most pleasant days, happiest days, I suppose, were just burying myself in the library at Cooperstown, you know, just like going through all their archives on any topic you want and, you know, photocopying them and keeping them, and just that feeling of discovery of stuff you didn't know about and stuff you could follow up on and new paths and new trails to go down. That was really cool. I mean, the Hall of Fame library is just a magic place. It's really one of my favorite places on earth. I just love it. So I hope to, you know, I spent a lot of time there, the first two books. You know, the funny thing, though, is that there aren't, like, they bring everything out to you. So there's not, like, stacks that you can, like, walk through, like, at a regular library. You have to request it. They have everything, and they'll gladly bring it out to you. But, like, I do still wonder. I'd love to, like, roam the racks. I would probably be just sensory overload. I would just be like picking out every book and just, I'd be
right. You get lost.
A disaster in there. Yeah. Yeah. The Hall of Fame itself is sensory overload. You know,
is
there's so much amazing stuff at an event like that, or at a place like that, that sometimes you just have to take a breath and decompress, because all of it is interesting and all of it's, you know, exciting.
Yes, and Cassidy Lent does a great job up there at the library.
Cassidy's great.
Yeah.
She's
absolutely correct. Recently, you wrote an article for The Athletic, and it's called "With New Uniforms, MLB Makes Another Fashion Flop."
What is
with these uniforms? And why is this such a controversial subject now? What is going on?
Well, I've always found that people have strong opinions on uniforms because it's one of those things that everybody has their own sense of fashion and of what looks good and what doesn't. But, so I've always kind of written about it and talked about it. I just think baseball is just so enraptured with Nike, and they're so infatuated with this partnership they have with Nike. Nike's paying a lot of money, obviously. And for that money, baseball just basically gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want. And they can't just leave well enough alone. I mean, it's hard to screw up a baseball uniform. Baseball uniforms are so great. But baseball is managing to do that with sort of an endless stream of these. First, the City Connect uniform. Some people like them. Some people don't. To me, they'll have some good elements, and then they'll just jazz it up with something stupid. And then now these ad patches just drive me crazy. I mean, the Royals announced one yesterday that's a big red block on their sleeve. And it's like the team is blue and white. It's always blue and white. Once they accented it with black briefly, and then, you know, they have the little gold and the crown. But, like, there's nothing. There's never been anything red about the Kansas City Royals. And now they have this stupid red patch. You know, there's never been anything green about the Toronto Blue Jays, and they have a big green patch. It's just so beyond the fact that it just, you know, it's so tacky, and it's like, you know, you shouldn't have it, it's incongruous, right? It's supposed to be a baseball uniform about the team. I can live with the manufacturer's logo. I'd rather it not be on the front like Nike, but I can live with it because that is the company that makes the shirt, the garment. But to have a sponsorship, like the Yankee pinstripes have Star Insurance on the side, it just looks so,
I know,
so tacky.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the Yankees. It's just, you know, it's just like, I don't know. And people say, oh, you know, it's okay. It's the way of the world. I'm like, oh, it doesn't, you know, if everybody else jumped off a bridge, it doesn't mean you have to, you know, right. Like it's just Yankees, like the Yankees don't allow a sponsor for the stadium, right? I bet they could make a lot of money if they called it, you know, Subaru Stadium, right? Like, actually, there is a Subaru Stadium in Philly, but, you know, or whatever. They could probably make a lot of money if they sold the naming rights to the Yankee Stadium. They don't, because they draw a line there. I think they should have drawn a line at the pinstripes.
Oh, absolutely. They should.
I think the Tigers should have drawn a line at their beautiful uniforms, and the Dodgers. I love baseball uniforms, man. I think, you know, they are the Braves. I mean, the Braves have such a great uniform, and they've got that quick creep, you know, a big yellow. They do have a little yellow in the uniform, but the big yellow concrete bag. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes sense because they make money, but I think just because you can make money doesn't mean you should. And as far as this year's issue, because they can't leave well enough alone, Nike, you know, signs these new uniforms, whatever, Fanatics produces them, and they're really cheap looking. The pants are see-through. The names on the back are really tiny. The players think they're terrible. The fans, once they see them, are going to be squinting at the names. It just makes no sense to hide your player's identity. Mm-hmm. The All-Star game, wearing generic uniforms. It's so stupid. Like, you're not passing the – you don't have to wear the same uniforms because you're passing the ball to somebody, like in basketball. Right. Like, players have – there's not going to be any real uniform confusion.
That's the best part of the All-Star game.
Yeah, it is. And Manfred doesn't understand that, or he's not allowed to say that he understands it because Nike's paying him so much money. He just has to say that Nike's great. But baseball, clearly, like I the analogy I use is that, like in that Seinfeld episode where George is trying to be cool with Elaine's cool boyfriend, and he's, you know, he's so infatuated by being friends with a cool guy that he wants to be, you know, just like him. And baseball should hone in on what makes it special and not try to be another notch in Nike's portfolio.
Yes.
I love how you gave the Seinfeld reference.
Yeah, and then everybody was like, oh, you should have done the thing with George, the, you know, the wool uniform, the cotton uniforms. I was going for like a infatuated with a cool guy analogy. But yeah, he did have a baseball uniform thing, so it's confusing. That was what came to me in the moment.
Tyler, we thank you for your time. I have one last question, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I heard you're an immaculate grid guru because you always get the low score, and it's like golf. You have to have the lowest score, the better. I didn't know that.
And if you miss one, you know, it sticks with you all day, or like it's like today I had a really nice board, but I could not think of anybody who played first base in the Negro Leagues, or was it who played first base and also played in the Negro Leagues except Jackie Robinson. And now I'm like, Buck O'Neill. But it makes you realize some gaps in your baseball knowledge. Like we all know the great names from the past, but basically before the expansion era, I'm not really good on positions, you know, I mean, catchers and pitchers, but like, was this guy an outfielder? If so, where did he play? Was he an infielder? Was he a second baseman or third baseman or short? I'm not really sure, you know, like that kind of thing. Like, so you realize some gaps in your knowledge, but I love it. Because I can do those team crossover things all day. Uh-huh. You know, somebody who played for this team and that team.
Right.
But when they start adding in the stats or right. the awards are okay, but the stats sometimes 30 saves or 200 strikeouts or something, cause you're going for a low score, right? You're not just going for like, you know, 200 hits, Yankees, Derek Jeter, you know, you're trying to think of someone really rare. So sometimes you're kind of like, you'll pick a guy and he only had 199 hits, damn, you know, or, you know, like 300 home runs, Bobby Abreu. No, he had 295 or whatever. So it's like, you know, you try for those low scores. Sometimes you get burned.
Yeah. My final question, 2006 Game 1 World Series.
Oh, that was funny because Anthony Reyes pitched for the Cardinals, and he did really well. He beat Verlander. Pujols hit a home run to the opposite field off Verlander, who's a rookie. And Reyes had this flat brim hat, and he never really did much else in his career. But that series with the Mets had gone on so long. Game 7, they had one day off, and then they were in Detroit, and they didn't really have anybody else. So they gave the ball to Anthony Reyes, and he dealt that one night. He got the Cardinals off to a good start.
Yeah, he did. Eight innings pitched, four hits, two runs, two earned runs. So
and like, you know, and they left well enough alone. Like they game five came around, and there was rain out or something. They gave it to Jeff Weaver, and Jeff, you know, did a great job and won it. So that was Reyes' only game, but he really stepped up. I tried to get him for the book for the Unsung Heroes chapter. He's like a fireman in LA or something. I couldn't get through. Like the PR department for the fire. I couldn't break through, but there was plenty of, it was a good chapter without him, but I do remember Anthony Reyes, being the unsung hero that night.
Yep. Thank you very much for your time. I mean, this has been terrific. I know we kept you a little longer than we told you, but we really appreciate it. And do you have any social media that people can follow you other than getting The Athletic?
Yeah, just get The Athletic. You know, okay. I'm on Twitter, X, and I just use Twitter, X, basically for tweet out my stories and Immaculate Grid and occasionally some opinions. But it's all good. Just happy to be here, and thanks, Scott, for having me. It was fun.
We appreciate it. Kyler. If you ever have like where you just can't think of what to write about, you could always write about a little podcast called Baseball and Barbecue, because we could use the publicity.
All right. Well, enjoy the barbecue, and we'll enjoy the baseball.
Thank you very
Thank you very much, Tyler.
All right, fellas.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And thank you, Tyler, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. Man, does he know his World Series starting pitchers, doesn't he?
That is, I'm telling you, that's a party skill. Yes. That is a party skill. Yes, he does. And you know, Jeff, isn't it amazing that Hall of Fame talk is always in? It's always interesting, even when we're not talking about who should go in.
Oh, my. You know, don't get me started, because everything on social media, you see this. Oh, Barry Bonds is not in the Hall of Fame. Pete Rose is not in the Hall of Fame. But we all know why. You don't have to keep rehashing it all the time.
Right. But to have Tyler with us talking about baseball, talking about the Hall of Fame, I hope everybody enjoyed that as much as I did.
Yes. And if you want to reach the show, give us a call at 516-855-8214. Email us baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a message on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. We have an X at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. mets.com. Please rate, review, subscribe, like, follow.
And you know what to do, Jeff, because I've got something. I've got something for our listening audience.
It's time for the barbecue quote of the week.
It's not a requirement for you to hate someone else's barbecue in order to love mine. That was said by Carrie Bringle, who will be a guest soon on the show. And that's a great quote. You know what else is great, Jeff? I'm loving the segue. What else is great? It's baseballbbq.com. You remember that?
Yes.
Everyone listening.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You've not been there, do it. Go to baseballbbq.com, baseball bat handle, tongs, forks, spatulas, cutting board shaped like home plate. Go there, baseballbbq.com.
Father's Day is coming up, so you know what to do. Also, Len, before we get to Byron Chisholm, I just want to give a shout out to a friend of ours who we're going to have on the show in a couple of weeks, and that's Bill Donahue, because he had on one of our guests, a former guest, Noah Cadell, and he was nice enough to shout out to us, so we are returning the favor. A shout out to Bill Donahue of WGBB Sports Talk. So take a listen to him when you get a chance. You can find on any of your podcast apps, and he's also on the web. So thank you, Bill.
And one other thing, Jeff, that I made a promise as well. Very thankful that Bill mentioned the show. We had a former guest, and that's John Furman from Bubba and Mothers. So they have Bubba and Mothers has a promotion. They are going to, hold on, I want to make sure I get this right. We've launched two new flavors, and at the end of the month, we begin our annual Memorial Day to Veterans Day run. In that time frame, a portion of every sale will go to veteran charities, both local and national. I had told John I thought it was a great thing. I wanted to mention that.
Thank you, John. Again, John's website is www.bubandmothers. I'll spell that out. BUBNMUTHAS.com.
Yeah. Quality products. Okay. Yeah. Speaking of a quality product, Jeff, can you imagine the fact or believe the fact that one product, a barbecue rub created 27 years ago, would now have over 50 million in sales?
It's an incredible story.
Yeah, it really is. And that is our guest, Byron Chisholm of Bad Byron's Butt Rub. Listen to Byron. We have a Hall of Famer. No, he didn't hit the most triples.
Not
or
Flamer.
But we have with us someone who, you know, for all you people that think, oh, I'm going to take my rub, bottle it, and make a fortune. There's only one person that could do that. He is a Hall of Famer. We are honored. We are so honored to have him with us through hard work. He's got a video. We're going to talk all about it. This man is the best. And his name is Byron Chisholm. Thank you for joining us, Byron.
Proud to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Byron. And your story is fascinating. And we're going to get into all of that. And your documentary, which is, we learned a lot about you. It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
It's go to buttrub.com. You can watch the documentary right there. But I want to start out, before we talk about the documentary, how you started in your barbecue journey. I know it started with a man named Jim Norton, didn't it?
It started by a gift of having a neighbor who was a fantastic barbecuer. And this was 1992 when barbecue was still an obscure regional thing. But it was before the barbecue boom, the internet, and all this. And so, you know, everybody had a grill, but almost nobody barbecued, you know, in this culture. And I'd had barbecue, but I couldn't, I wouldn't have been able to produce it until you have someone like Jim at that time, you know, to show you how to do it. And in this case, he built my cooker. And, you know, I was cooking for a living. And I love cooking, and I've lived for it. But man, I couldn't produce a brisket or a pork butt. Could hardly tell you the difference between the two. But once I started barbecuing, that was a whole nother level. You know, you're cooking underneath the stars with live fire. People reacted to it 10 times better than any other food. You know, so it was a gift.
It's called Barbecue. It's BBQ Dreams, the butt rub story. And we're honored to have you on. But at the same time, as soon as this interview is over, I suggest everyone go watch that video because it's on YouTube. And to say video makes it sound like a cheap video. It's a 47-minute story on your history. And there's Tuffy Stone is in the video. Dr. Barbecue is in the video. So you spared no expense on this video, and it really tells your story so well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That's very nice. I'm real proud of how it turned out. It was our 25th anniversary was a couple of years ago, and that kind of inspired, you know, it's like you started collecting all the memorabilia and going through the old graphs and charts and, you know, started piecing it together. And everybody was like, man, you need to document this. You need to really document this. And so I'm like, yeah, I guess I do. Well, I'm still young enough to remember the details. Yeah, Dr. Barbecue, we go way back to my first major barbecue competition that I was participating in. And Tuffy and I go back to when I had been cooking a few years before he started. And I remember when he started. So these are friends of mine. These aren't like people I hired to say, hey, nice things. Right. They showed up in support, and I'm real proud of that. I'm real grateful for that. No, it's I'm really pleased that turned out. Chris Wheeler is the producer and director, and we spent at least a year on this, and we dug through all the archives, all the old footage from different things that were on TV, and I don't know. I was real proud of being able to tell the story, and hopefully – I mean, if everybody's into barbecue, they're going to love the barbecue footage and the humor and just talking about how I went from absolute nothing to something. Anyway, thank you for the kind words.
Well, you're welcome. But you would have been a champion dirt bike rider. We know you were really good, right? I guess now where we are, our parents aren't getting us dirt bikes. But yeah. Your father bought you a dirt bike, what, for a birthday or something, right?
I think I begged him to the breaking point. I think that's what did it. I begged him to the breaking point. And I'm 12 years old when I got it. So I must have started about 10.
Wow.
You know, I just something that I connected with. And looking back, you know, I wasn't, although I played football and baseball, bowling, things like that. It was like, okay, all right, whatever. But then when I got on that dirt bike, it was like, whoa, it was just something connected really deep with me. And I had the unique skills for that, but then I didn't have for football or baseball or basketball for that matter. I'm 5'6", all right? I'm grateful for motocross because for 6 years, I was in my element, my niche, and I was able to accomplish something. And it really kind of set the pace for adulthood. Even though it was on pause for a big section of my life, but it really made me believe that I could accomplish something when I set my mind to it throughout the dormant years until I got out of college and started cooking.
And that college, I guess you went after college, you went to the CIA in New York.
That's right. But not right away. I graduated from college in 1990 and I enrolled in Culinary Institute in 1995. So mm-hmm. It was after I found that cooking was something I believed in and something I felt like I had a future in. It was then that I'm like, well, if I'm doing this, I want to learn more and I want to learn from the best. And so I moved to New York and it was a great experience. I loved every minute of it. I spent 2 winters in New York. I didn't even know it was freezing half the time. I was just so involved and so in love with the school I went to. It was a great experience I'll cherish forever.
And that's part of the documentary that you know, a couple of years at the CIA.
Yes, sir. We did cover that. That's for sure.
Yeah. What I liked about the documentary, and it's really got, it really caught my eye, is the Butt Ranch BBQ theme park.
Hey, I'm sure I'm at right this second. I'm sitting at the theme park. We're closed today. Those names were given to me. I just had a place that I kept my RV. Because it's in Central Tennessee, and most of 21 years of competition, I was traveling a lot, and I'm up here in the middle of the South. The Tennessee Valley, which basically just south of Nashville, just north of Birmingham, Alabama, this is like the epicenter of the Southern events back in those days. So I just wanted an RV cover to keep my stuff here. I was dragging 10,000-pound trailer back to Florida after every event. So that's how it started. And then I started building on, you know, guest house here. Next thing you know, I had an outdoor kitchen. One thing led to another. And the first time I ever had a real party, it was just in the early days of Facebook. And a friend of mine, Nancy Montgomery, she took a bunch of pictures and said, "We had a great time at the Butt Ranch." She just threw that out there. You know, butt rub. And it's a ranch setting. All right. And then the barbecue theme park, the guys were coming out here laying the line for the electrical. And I asked one of the builders that was out here, said, "Man, what are y'all building here?" And he just off the top of his head said, "I think it's a barbecue theme park." I love that, man. And so the two names came from two different people, but I use them together. The barbecue theme park helps explain what the Butt Ranch is, because if you didn't know we were barbecuing, you would wonder.
You know, Byron, we might have set a record, because other than, I think, in my intro, I don't think we've actually spoken or asked you about the product that, you know, people might know.
Gives you the name.
And that is Bad Byron's Butt Rub. It's such a distinctive logo. It's a woman pig standing up with a chef hat, bare butt, and it is, and there's a story behind that. So tell us.
You say bare butt, but pigs don't wear clothes anyway. You know?
That's right. They're all right. Exactly. They're all bare. That's very good.
Yeah. So when I started barbecuing in the South, you know, Jim taught me how to barbecue. It was the Boston butt that, you know, that's what you cooked. I mean, you could whole hog's the original. And then years later, the retail cuts came in the competition arena. It was the whole shoulder, but for just cooking barbecue, you know, the butts were the thing in the South, and they still are. Now the rub comes from Texas. That's the origin of a barbecue rub is from Central Texas. It came from the German, Czech influence. They all had this just district where they have meat markets, and they still do. But they all settled Central Texas, and, you know, they made the sausages and all the things, you know. Well, they came up with the offset cooker and all this. But it was salt and pepper, half and half. That's the mother rub. That's where it all started. And, you know, over time, especially with competitions also began in Texas, people started adding things to it to kind of make theirs a little better, a little different, especially if they're competing. So over time, all these rubs evolved, but it all started with salt and pepper. And the true original barbecue rub is savory. It's salt and pepper. And that's, I knew enough about that to make my own rub. And it was salt and pepper based. And I just added a few other things. Never even imagined sugar, which would come later. And that I was mostly out of competition barbecue. People were doing all kind of, you know, they were trying everything. But nonetheless, but that's in the South. It was the butts, but the rub came from Texas. And I grew up in Texas, so I kind of married the two together. I'm like, I got a rub for butts. I called it butt rub. It was so basic, it's scary. But everybody loved to use it in a sense, you know, and it got people's attention, and it was funny. And, you know, and we discovered that, you know, butt rub is very versatile. So a little butt rub makes everything better. That made them laugh even more. So I'm like, I'm having a great time with this thing, you know. And when the store started selling it, when I, you know, in the documentary talks about how I went from just making it as a gift to deciding, hey, you know, let me see if I can sell some of them. Well, that's when I realized that butt rub and the butt rub makes everything better, got people's attention, and I had an opportunity here, in which took the plunge. And here we are 27 years later. Yeah, here we go.
And 50 million plus in sales.
That's right. And for a single barbecue seasoning, that's pretty unique. There's a lot of big companies out there now. There's a lot of products. But we have a faithful following that just we hold our own. You know, we're able to brand loyalty. That's the thing. You know, I've been fortunate enough to reach that level with a lot of people. And that's how we're in business, the brand loyalty.
And in the documentary, I mean, it shows you making your butt rub at your kitchen table. And then later in the documentary, you have this big warehouse with with pallets coming out and forklifts. And it was amazing how you took going from the kitchen table to this massive warehouse that you have.
Well, now, okay, so that was a span of 25 years in the documentary. So the photographs for me making it, that was 97. And in the end of the documentary, it was our 25th year anniversary. So, that was a span of 25 years. You know, we're talking about no investors, no investment group, no loans. It's just organic. Hey, well, let's do this, and that's working, so let's do that. And just step by step, brick by brick. The big fortune is the timing was really good, because as I was getting this, just as I was getting in grocery stores, and not big grocery stores, but smaller grocery stores, that's about the time to, you know, barbecue started being on TV, and you know, everybody wanted a rub. Well, we were one of the absolute very few out on the market. It just kind of took off, and the people that we were presenting to started calling us. Said, "Oh yeah, remember that rub you tried to sell? We want to buy some now." So, timing had a lot to do with it, but it was a very organic, natural thing that I'm grateful that I just had the idea at the right time, and it was just. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, you follow your heart and it takes you to good places sometimes.
You were a visionary, because look at the shelves now. Look at barbecue now. You knew back then this is something that it has a future. And obviously it did.
I don't know how much of a visionary I am. I do know that I believed in what I was doing. And I believed in it because of the feedback I was getting from people.
Right.
So I followed that. And the doors just started to open, and it was a beautiful time to be getting into that. And most anyone into the barbecue world, it was whatever you did in barbecue, you know, this barbecue jet was about to leave the tarmac. And so we were in for the early ride, and that was a blessing. Sure.
Yeah. Byron, we talked briefly about, you know, you getting and it's true. You got a dirt bike when you were 12, and your parents are they're part of the business. They're in the video part of the business. I'm just talk about a little bit about growing up in Texas. And I mean, was cooking a part of your life at all then? I mean, you talk to people, and a lot of times they have, you know, grandparents that they learned from or something. I just want to hear something about your background.
Well, I grew up in Orange, Texas. It was a good time, great relationship with my parents, and my community was in the 70s, you know. We didn't have as many problems as we do now. We didn't know there was any problems, if there was any. So it was a good time. As far as cooking goes, it wasn't until I got to college as a freshman in college that I started cooking. And that was simply because the cafeteria food at college was not so good. And you can't go out to eat all the time. What else is there? There's a kitchen, that I had access to. And I just jumped in there and started swinging around. And I don't know. It just kind of came natural. And I had some mentors. I was in college in Mobile, Alabama, and I had three aunts and uncles and my grandmother that lived there. And so I'd ask them questions, and it just came natural. And I liked it. And then anything you can do to impress your friends, you stick with that. Because everybody was like, "Ooh, he knows how to cook." You know, it's like, yeah, I do know how to cook. What you want? So yeah,
it's not just barbecue, because you're a chef, and you know, it's just barbecue is just a method of cooking that you've taken to. But you have many methods.
Yeah, it started with that in a college environment, and then over the years, I got more and more serious, and like I said, by the time I got out of college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't want to live in a city. I didn't want to wear a suit. You know, I just didn't know. It was really a tough time. And when the day I decided, well, let's just go with what you'd like to do and see how that works. And that was cooking and the beach. That was the things that really lit me up. And I literally moved to the beach, decided I was going to try my hand at cooking for a living. I had no other, I was like, let's just go with that and see what happens. And to this day, I know I'm in Tennessee more now than I am in Florida, but our headquarters is still in Florida. So that's been a 30-year-plus relationship with the beaches of Northwest Florida. It's worked out somehow.
Where did you get the nickname Bad Brian? Where did the bad come from?
Well, going back to the lacrosse days, there was a racer, and he's still with us today. His name is Brad Lackey. And when he got to be world champion, he was the first American world champion in motocross. And anyway, he got the name Bad Brad. And I remember I had one big race that I did good in, and this little local newspaper, this little local motocross paper, to talk about Bad Byron. And it was just a play on words because Bad Brad's a big guy, and I'm just this little guy. But, and I liked that, and it was kind of cool. And every now and then, a few people call me Bad Byron. And that name went kind of dormant for a long time. I made baked beans for a party one time, and they said, oh, is this Byron's baked beans? I'm like, no, that's Bad Byron's baked beans. And so I started using that name again.
And it's now on all your bottles, but you also go by...
Well, when I decided to start marketing your products, that name came to mind. You know, I don't know. Give them something to... You know, you got to dress it up a little bit. So.
And in a documentary, there's some people calling you Buttman.
Yeah. Well, my first employee, Susan Thompson, when I met her, she was working at Waffle House, and I'd go in there every morning. It was a little routine I had, and all they knew was I had a product called Butt Rub, and they didn't know my name. They just nicknamed me Butt Man. And then one day they finally asked for my name. She said, we just call you Butt Man. So she still calls me Butt Man. Yeah, she sure does. Yep.
So tell us how you began in the competition. You know, that was in 1998 you began competing. And is that where
So Butt Rub, I started in 1997. That was my first sales. So now I got this new job. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm all in. I'm not doing this part-time or nothing like this. I'm like, what can I do today or this weekend or next weekend to reach the barbecue-loving people out there? And I discovered the National Barbecue News had all the competitions that were going on listed. I started circling the ones that I could get to, and I started going to these events to promote Butt Rub. I thought, well, all right, I got a barbecue product. These are barbecue people. So I would cook chicken wings, hand them out all day long, and hopefully sell enough product and enough t-shirts to pay for my trip. Most of the time I did, but mostly I was building a long-term relationship. If I could introduce them to the product, we could then sell it to them, you know, via buttrub.com, which was on the ground floor. Our internet, buttrub.com, came along about 1998. That was pretty early for the internet order sites. So I had a mail order through buttrub.com from the ground floor. And that's when I started competing, because after I've been doing that for a while, I realized that if I was out there winning some of these competitions or even being competitive, that would give the product credentials. Because obviously, I don't know, people like the name, they like the slogan. I had a lot of winning things going, but I wanted to take the product serious. And I figured, if I can build myself to a point where I'm winning big trophies, then that's just a feather in the cap for credentials. And that would help people. That would just help me separate myself from my competitors, which were all big corporations. And nobody had won no trophies. The competition barbecue cooks hadn't started marketing products back then. I don't even say the first one, but I mean, of all the stores I was in, it was the big, big companies that, you know, and I'm like, I'd like for people to know that this is a grassroots product, and the person who created this was a barbecue champion. And it was my drive that got me out of bed every morning. And so for 21 years, I competed. And I'd say the first 10 years, I set the bar where I had the credentials I was looking for, but I enjoyed it so much, I just kept doing it.
So. Yeah, Byron, you retired from competing 2 years ago. Right.
Yeah, I did. It ran its course like most things. It was the most wonderful time. You know, I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. And I think since I was about ready to kind of pull the ropes up about 2012, and that was when the first KCBS barbecue event was international in Europe, and that was in Amsterdam. And I heard about it. I'm like, KCBS has had we got an event coming up in Amsterdam. I'm like, man, I'm going. I didn't know where I was staying or where I was going to get my grill, where I was going to get my meat. But I'm like, I'm going. We'll figure out all the rest of the stuff later. And sure enough, that was the first one, and there's been hundreds since then. it all worked out. I had a lot of help on that end. The people, you know, they were very hospitable to me and provided me with everything I needed. And I was the only American there. It was a great experience. And I'm like, when's the next one? Where's it going to be? And golly, you know, 8 years went by, and that was about 16 European countries that I competed in before it was over.
Yeah.
Including the first one in the Eastern Bloc, which was in Slovenia. So for the most part, there were other Americans that came along, but I highly recommended it to anybody. I'm like, look, they'll help you get your equipment. It's a great experience. But for the most part, on the early days, I was the first one to compete in a lot of these countries, almost all of them that I competed in.
Yep. And you can see a list of them on buttrub.com/awards. And it's a beautiful picture of all the trophies there and the competition highlights and the championships everywhere. I mean, talk about being impressive. You should be in the Barbecue Hall of Fame. Oh, wait a second. You are in the Barbecue Hall of Fame.
Yeah. I'm very proud of that. That was about a year ago today that I found out that I was going to be. The induction ceremony was last October in Kansas City. Yeah, that was icing on the cake. Man, I'm really so proud of that. I don't know. It's hard to say what a gift barbecue's been to me through business, through competition. Just every time I fire a grill, I just fall in love with it all over again. Think like.
Well, you may have I don't even know if you retire in barbecue competition because you can, you know, unretire, but you now coach teams, right? At the at your compound there in Tennessee. Don't you have some teams you coach?
I haven't found that teaching is my niche, but I've got a facility here. And so we've had barbecue classes here. Mm-hmm. Every spring I like to have a barbecue class. I'm kind of broadening that out to outdoor cooking in general. But my goal, my biggest thing I'm working on these days is fill this facility here. You know, I want to do events here, and we do two or three a year already. And then with the class, that's four a year. It's not so much the quantity as the quality. Instead of just traveling all over like I have been doing, I'm in charge of my own events now, and I'm able to use barbecue as a way of like, for example, Brisket and Bluegrass is in September. It's my fifth year to do it. The people that come for this, they've never had, for the most part, they've never had really good brisket. And, you know, it's a treat for them. And then we have beautiful bluegrass music, and we'll raise money for the animal shelters and other animal causes. So it's a beautiful thing that I can use what I know something about, which is barbecue, with my place here that I've been working on, the theme park, if you will. It's a special treat to me that we can have a function where people will love the music, love the food, and we're doing it all for a good cause. So that's where I'm at in my life cycle with barbecue.
And Byron, your product is very focused. It's well known. And it reminds me of another product that was sold, and that's Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce. Do you think that you'll ever want to sell the product to a big corporation or something?
Well, I think that what I know about it all, you know, is the natural life cycle of a food product that is successful. It reaches a point somewhere down the line that you hand it off to a bigger company. They're like, okay, you've done your test marketing. You've established a base. You've shown that there's appeal for this product. And so we're a bigger company. We have all these resources and we want to buy your product. So that's kind of how it generally works. Now, I think that's what will happen for me also. I'm not in a hurry to sell it. We're still growing the business. We're still enjoying it. But when the right partner comes along, that's the way I'm going to have to go. Can't work forever. Can't going to live forever. And I don't have, like, my staff and all, they all started when I did. I'm proud to say I've got five people now that have been with the company 20 years. Or more. You know, we're all going to retire at some point in life. I'm at a point where I'm still enjoying it. When the right partner comes along, I'll know it because I've known what to do, you know, up to this point. I've known when to make decisions, when to make the move. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that'll be the inevitable direction for Butt Rub, just not
I'm letting it take its course naturally. And when the right person, time, and company comes along, that'll be the way to go. Yeah.
Byron, getting back to the documentary, I got to say that everybody should take a look at this. It's important to have music with the barbecue. And forgive me, I forgot the name of the group, but you had a group that played at the Grand Ole Opry in the documentary.
Yeah, 51 times.
Yeah, 51 times.
y'all did your homework. That was Darren and Brooke Aldridge. They're one of the most successful acts in bluegrass at this moment. In fact, they just debuted a number one hit. They've had a bunch of number ones since they did that documentary. They're great people. And I love the whole group bluegrass genre. The stars are very approachable, and it's a good thing. Yeah, I like, of course, you know, from all these competitions I've been to all these years, the best ones had great music. So you got barbecue and music. You know, it can be any kind of music. I think the bluegrass is just, until you've seen it live, you really haven't experienced it. It's the harmony it's just a beautiful thing to see, experience. I didn't really think I liked bluegrass until I saw it live, and I fell in love with it. And that was, of course, that was a barbecue and bluegrass event in Dillard, Georgia, and that's at the very tip north of Georgia on the North Carolina border. And I know I went to that event 20 years, and so that's where I learned about group bluegrass. So I carried that influence here to my place, because most people, they might like some bluegrass. They don't know bluegrass, but when you see it, it changes you. Mm-hmm. The good stuff, really. You know,
You know, I'm looking at your video here, and I see that you have a smoker in the background. I'm just wondering, how many of those do you have at the Butt Ranch Barbecue?
The Butt Ranch? Park? I couldn't give you a number. I got more than I need, for sure. The interesting thing, though, is I've got the original above ground pit that was the first design from the Deep South. It's a cinder block pit. And that's where we do the whole hog zone. And we do other stuff on it. But that method, that was the first. They dug trenches, and they cooked in the trenches until this above ground cinder block pit evolved, probably in the, this could have been, who knows, 30s, 40s. I've got original pit like that. And then the offset, that was created out of Central Texas, just like the rub. And in fact, a lot of the traditional places you go to, they still have those original pits, and they're beautiful. And I was excited. I wanted one years back, and I had to have it built in Texas and shipped out here. So I've got the original Texas pit, and I got the original Southern pit here. And we cook on them for these events. Right. And I know in the fall, when we're 10 minutes from Jack Daniel's distillery, and we have the Jack Daniel's World Championship, we host a lot of the international teams here, as many as we could host, and then we have a big reception for them. But I want them to know, if they're in love with barbecue, I want them to know how it started. This is the original above ground pit. It wasn't mobile, it wasn't on trailer, and this is the original Texas pit, which made Texas barbecue famous. And that's where that barbecue started, and this is where Southern barbecue started, with these pits. So it's always an education to them. And we're cooking on them usually when they're here. And so that's been kind of my thing with that.
Yeah, yeah. You have the first pit that you built with Norton. You still have that, right?
I do. Yeah. Let's see if you can see it. Uh-huh. See that grill?
Oh, yeah, in the corner there. Yes, yes,
that's it.
Yes.
I actually didn't put it there to stage it. I put it there because there's a ledge, and I don't want people walking off that ledge. So I actually put it there to keep people...
It's a blocker.
All over that ledge. It's interesting that it's in the picture. That's it. That's my my first love there. Yeah.
So basically, you've spent time in Texas, New York, Tennessee, Florida. So you consider yourself a New Yorker, right, Byron?
I consider myself glad to get out of there when I graduated in March of 1996. No, it was a good experience. I was in Hyde Park, New York. I loved it. I loved it. You know, I've got to get home to my roots. So although I grew up in Texas and I went to college in Alabama and I lived in Florida, I was always on the Gulf Coast. Where I lived in Texas and in Mobile and in the Florida Panhandle, I was on the Gulf of Mexico and communities and all those. So it was different states, but it was a common thread. I'm very connected to all that. The Tennessee thing just kind of happened by accident. I got up here in the rural area, and it was just country and fresh air and just, you know, wide open spaces and real friendly neighbors. And I just, over time, it's just, man, I just wanted to be here. I cook and everybody show up and there was no traffic and there was no, it's just, I still love it. It's just a great little place to get away
from. It's beautiful. Yeah. Everything. It looks beautiful.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. We should tell everybody to go to buttrub.com. You know, I was looking at your site. You do have a shop site here, and you have more than just your butt rub barbecue season, which is obviously your number one product. But you also have sauce. You have the Bad Byron's Jubilee seafood seasoning as well. And it looks like you have some honey also and coffee. So great place to shop. And you can go online and look at it. Or there's some retailers near you where you put in your zip code and it'll tell you where butt rub can be purchased, and is one right a mile away from me, which is very convenient.
Yes, it is. So Byron, we are, first of all, I can't believe that the time flew by, but we are, you know, cognizant of your time and respectful. But I do have to ask you this. For people in barbecue, for people that have podcasts like this, and we know that there's a Barbecue Hall of Fame, and it's very special. You were inducted in 2023, and we're very honored and that you were, and it's a big honor. But when you got that call, when you found out that you had made it in, did it mean more to you than you thought it would?
It meant about as much to me as I can imagine. You know, it's just something about your peers, you know, collectively saying, I mean, because it gets down to, you know, a lot of people are nominated and it gets down to 10. And then from the 10, the voters have to choose 4. So it's like, whew. I mean, you know, I didn't know, you know, I just didn't know. And, but when they said that I was a final four that was going to be inducted, I was just inducted. It's hard to explain how I felt, but basically my 26 years at that point have been validated that you did something, you know, you've done something. You've made an impact in barbecue. At least the voters and the people that study all this, that was their conclusion. And it meant the world to me. It still does. Nice. I appreciate you asking.
It's interesting because you have this successful company. You know it's a success. You have a staff. You're in business. It's doing great things. But something like this validated it, which I get totally, but it's just amazing. And so I'm just so glad that there is a Barbecue Hall of Fame. I think it'd be great to have an actual physical building that people could go through and have exhibits and stuff. But it's just a fantastic thing.
I sure appreciate all that. Thank you very much. Yeah. And maybe, you know, I would expect maybe in the future that there will be something you could physically, you know,
right,
experience doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important. And Byron, we thank you very much for joining us. Other than, well, your website is buttrub.com. Don't worry, you'll be
okay. What else could it be?
buttrub.com. Yeah. And it's fantastic. Go on there. Watch Byron's video. It's on YouTube. But the easiest way to see it is go to buttrub.com, and it's right there.
Yeah, I actually searched the butt rub story on Google, and it pulls right up. Yeah. It's a 47 minute, because there's also a what do you call it, trailer? That's, you know, teaser thing. But the butt rub story by itself on Google will pull up the documentary. I'm so glad we talked about that, because it really 27 years and 47 minutes, but it's got that little American dream theme going. And certainly got some barbecue eye candy and a little humor, and I'm grateful that it's also inspired people who've watched it that are into other things. It's like, well, that inspired me to double down and do something with this idea or that idea. So I'm glad that's been a little bit of an inspiration to a few people.
Yeah. Yep.
No, and you also have a Facebook group, the Butt Rub Club.
Butt Rub Club. Yeah. So
go on there and join the club.
It's a great club.
Where you been? Yeah, where you been?
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Byron.
You're the best. Byron, you're the best.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Jeff and Leonard. It's been a wonderful time for me. So I'm glad to have visited with you all this evening.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Thank you, Byron. You know, Jeff, he was great. And what I want to compliment us on the fact that we didn't go right away to, hey, you have a successful rub. We really, it took us quite some time to get there. That's because he's so interesting. It's not the first thing you want to discuss. So thank you very much, Byron.
Yeah, check out that documentary. It is fantastic.
Yeah, you could tell that we enjoyed it. We watched it. I watched it a few times already. So it's very good.
Len, you know I'm upset.
Uh-oh.
It's just, we're recording this on Wednesday. It's going to be released on Saturday. Mets just got swept by the Guardians. They're 2-8 in the last 10 games. They just stink. That's all I can say.
Oh, well, I thought that you were going to go with our Cleveland connections and we were going to do a shout out to Greg Rempe, who you could tell he's really sympathizing with us as he tweets us on a daily basis saying 1 in a row, 2 in a row, and now it'll be 3 in a row. So, and well, of course,
I got a couple texts from Farley Dillinger of the Baseball PhD podcast.
I was going to say, I'm sure you did.
Monday, sorry, Jeff. Tuesday, sorry, Jeff. Today, sorry, Jeff.
Well, it's nice to have that Cleveland connection, isn't it?
Yes.
The Guardians are having a great year. So anyway, we are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But you know what, Jeff? We have done a lot of podcasts, 2 outstanding guests, a quote of the week, shout outs, product mentions. I mean, we're done. A lot of shows. So thank Tyler Kepner. Go ahead, Jeff. Thank him.
Thank you, Tyler Kepner.
Thank Byron Chisholm.
Thank you, Byron Chisholm.
Thank me.
Thank you, Len.
Thank yourself.
Thank you, Jeff.
And thank you to our listeners. We appreciate all of you. Until episode 241, goodbye. Jeff, I said goodbye. What I meant to say was, how do we end things?
With the poet.
That is Shel Krakowski.
And the musician.
Dave Dresser.
And the song.
Baseball always brings you home.
Now you can say goodbye, Len.
Goodbye, Len. Bring the applause.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.